time for The Outspoken Cyclist, a weekly conversation about cycles, cyclists, travel, trails, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. WJCU broadcasts and streams The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show at 8 a.m. every Saturday morning. In Northeast Ohio, tune in to 88.7 FM, or worldwide, listen in at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for December 12th, 2020. I hope this finds you safe and well. We have a most interesting show tonight, highlighting two amazing people and the work that they do. His voice is unmistakable, and his ability to recall facts, figures, names, dates, and stages of any continental race for the past 4+ decades is staggering. Yep, you guessed it. My guest today is Phil Liggett. Spending the 2020 cycling season at home in England, Phil was able to continue in his role as the voice of the Tour de France this year with the help of NBC, technology, and Bob Roll, who was in Connecticut. While we spoke of the 2020 season, what he believes will happen in 2021 and going forward, and other things bike, what we finally came to focus on was a new project that is near and dear to him, the Paul Sherwin Project. Her voice is persistent, compelling, and gets amazing results as a professional cyclist, author, filmmaker, and activist for women's rights. Catherine Bertin, whose documentary Half the Road still garners a regular royalty check 6 years later, signed her first professional cycling contract at the age of 37, only to experience being benched the next year, suffering verbal and physical abuse from the team manager and staff. Still, she kept standing up and speaking out, using journalism, filmmaking, and Change.org petitions to effect change, garnering over 100,000 signatures to bring back La Course, the Tour de France for women. We hear more of her story in the second half of the show. Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin had the longest-running sports relationship in history, partnering for 33 years. Paul was an integral part of the team that became the voice of cycling. But 2 years ago this month, the world woke up to the news that Paul had died suddenly, and the world lost a generous, smart, and dedicated man. In an effort to continue Paul's legacy of helping the people of Uganda, where he and his wife Catherine lived, as well as keeping his memory alive, the Paul Sherwin Project was recently launched. So here we are to combine the best of the best, talking bicycles and giving with Phil Liggett. Hello, Phil. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm delighted to have a chance to talk with you and catch up. How are you?
I'm really good, Diane. Of course, like everybody else, suffering with being locked up for too long. I haven't actually been doing any traveling since I came back from South Africa, which was the end of May. And, of course, we reported the Tour de France. I reported it from London TV studios, but it worked well. So that side of life was pretty good.
So you were able to do some race calling, promoting by what did you use, like Zoom?
No, we NBC, who are owners of Sky TV, they opened their studios in London for me at the Sky offices. And I went in every day to Sky Television, and that's the first time in 48 years I actually haven't been on the Tour de France. I went to the studio every morning, got there about 8 o'clock, did my job for NBC. Bob Rowe, my co-commentator, he was over in Stamford, Connecticut, and I could see him on a small TV screen, so we knew when we were talking. And the end result basically was the highest viewing figures for 10 years. So everybody was very happy.
Wow. Who knew, right?
Yeah, it was. It was great. In fact, so much so that because COVID is still with us, I don't think there'll be time for NBC to actually organize all the logistics of going out to the Tour de France next year, because it's only a couple of months away. It's in the month of July again now. And I think they might well go for the same system next year and return to the old system of being on site from 2022, which will be my 50th tour, which is quite amazing.
Things have changed so much, and that was one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit. So the season was sort of shortened, and so if 2022 is coming, or 2021 is coming just next month, do you see anything happening with the Spring Classics?
At the moment, they're scheduled to run. All of our Spring Classics after sort of early March were cancelled or shifted out to the new season, which began on August the 1st. And a race like the Amstel Gold Classic, that simply was postponed. It didn't happen. Right. At the moment, the calendar is showing dates for all of these races in their usual slots. But, you know, one has to be cognizant that the COVID is still raging throughout Europe. Britain's one of the worst places on the tally board, if you like. France is ahead of us. They're not good at all just now. Germany are not good. Spain are not good. So we've got to wait and see what happens in the month of January and February. But at the moment, the classics are slotted to be where they should be. There will definitely be restrictions and all the usual COVID precautions, I'm sure, because, you know, this problem is not going to leave us overnight now. We've got the vaccine started to be administered in Britain today. The first to receive it was a 90-year-old woman. It'll be a while before it gets to people of my age. It's the only thing I think I ever can say I'm too young to have. It's terrible, isn't it? But hopefully by about March, April, we should be seeing the downward trend start. I really hope so.
Yeah, me too. Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. If you do not recognize that voice, you do not know anything about cycling. We are speaking with Phil Liggett. He is in England. We are here in the States. We are going to talk about the Paul Sherwin project a little bit later in the show. What do you think about the Tour Down Under? Is that going to happen in Australia?
No, not at all. Well, I say not at all. That's wrong. There is going to be a festival of cycling during the period of the Tour Down Under, which is about the third week in January. So Adelaide are putting on a festival. There'll be film shows. There'll be a little bit of racing. There'll be all sorts of things. They haven't revealed their full plans yet. However, the actual Tour Down Under opening the World Tour, that won't happen. There was too many problems. The government seemed willing to work with the riders, but frankly, the riders weren't willing to really come. If they had gone to Australia, which is very strict on its COVID restrictions, they would have had to have quarantined, probably in the Barossa Valley or somewhere like that, the wine region, speak with no one for maybe 2 weeks, then ride the race, then return to either Europe or Asia and probably do a quarantine period again. It became to appear unworkable. So no. So that event will take, it'll really be a national happening. And, of course, will be a big loss of income to the state of South Australia, because they were getting 800,000 spectators watching that event, and it was pulling big bucks into the economy in South Australia. But that will be back. It's a great organisation, but not this January. Hopefully 2022, when I'll be able to get back there.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you, and you alluded to it right now with the loss of income, things are going to change for cycling, I think, in general. We're seeing sponsors sort of bouncing around. And sponsorship is the way the sport works right now. You know, somebody owns a team. I guess that's the way to put it. Yeah. What do you think is going to happen going forward? Things have had to change this year. Some teams have new sponsors. Some teams have not been re-upped. What do you think is going to happen? Or what might be a better way of getting cycling financed? I guess that's the right word.
Well, you're right. At the moment, I feel we're on an upward trend. If you asked me this question maybe 3 weeks ago, I would say we were looking for a very sticky winter, getting the race on the road with the same strength that it's concluded 2020. But things have taken a much better turn wholesalely, because, for example, NTT, the South African sponsored team, NTT announced a surprise withdrawal from sponsorship by the end of this season. It looked as though the team was going to be lost. A lot of the riders grabbed whatever contracts were on offer. And they've just come up with a new sponsor. It's Quebeco, which are the bicycles, which they've always supported, getting bikes to kids in South Africa. But they've also teamed up with the Swiss clothing firm Assos. And it obviously has been quite a nice influx of cash because they've built the team. Today they've announced their last two riders. So they've got a very, very good stable of 27 World Tour riders now. So from what looked like no team at all, it's coming back as a very strong team. The trouble with cycling is its sponsorship doesn't come from gate money or from television rights. So the only people involved in sponsoring cycling are, as you rightly say, basically the people who own the teams. And so that's a big outlay for the company with no other form of income. Plenty of TV exposure. And consequently, they've received money in the past from tourism, people that want to sell the wares around the world. There's no better way to do it than to sponsor a cyclist who's riding literally around the world in the most beautiful places, and vacations and stuff like that, tourism vacations. And so we were fearsome that we might lose those sponsors. But again, Team Sunweb this week have announced they're going to be taken over by Team DSM, which is a nutritional food company. And they've upped the ante a bit, changing the colours. Mitchelton Scott seemingly have agreed to go on for at least two and maybe more years. And Mitchelton is a winery in South Australia. And fortunately, Jerry Reiner owns that. The winery is a great cycling fan as well. And he's an entrepreneur. But he is not a philanthropist. So he's got involved with this team for some years now, since about 2010. And it's going on again. So the trend has gone back up again. I take my hat off to the world body and the organisers. Through what seemed like a lost season, they managed to get off the ground most of the big races, including the three major tours and the world championships. And we actually had a very good racing period, which produced the champions. So I think that we can look forward to a strong year next year, despite all that we've faced. We've been up for the challenge and we've met it. And, you know, when you think what they've achieved, to run a race over 3 weeks around a complete country through all the zones which they called red zones of the COVID to keep everybody safe was a remarkable achievement. So let's hope we can do it again better next year.
Wow, you are so right. Let's take a moment again to reintroduce you, and then we'll take a short break. We're speaking with Phil Liggett. We've been talking about this past cycling season, COVID, sponsorship, and we're going to talk about a project that I think is going to be near and dear to his heart, and I think when you hear about it, it will be near and dear to yours. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Phil Liggett. He's in England. We're here in the States. We're not quarantined, but we're far enough apart. We're definitely socially distanced. Before the break, we were talking about sponsorship and financing teams. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about were the women's teams. They seem to be suffering more. Do you think that anybody's going to step up for some of the women's teams and see more racing for women?
It's been on the upward trend for a long, long time. COVID has obviously affected the women's racing, but no more so than the men's. The women have had their racing as well, and the women have now got their superstars on the teams too. Next year, the Tour de France has promised a female Tour de France again, which is more than welcome. And women's racing action now is really attractive to watch. It is no longer what it was maybe 25 years ago. So I think the women will come through strongly again next year. I think they're there. I don't see any reason why they shouldn't progress at the same speed as the men. Prize money is pretty equal in most cases now. And they've got a fantastic racing calendar. And as I say, some of the races I've watched this year have been better than watching the men's races. And that's what's most important. At the end of the day, they've got to have pulling power to get the viewers to watch them on television. And Women's Racing for My Money has achieved that. And now, I think they're going to go through and go from strength to strength.
That's awesome. Last thing I want to talk about before we get to our project is superstars. Who do you see coming up in 2021 as some of the star race? I love when you laugh like that.
Well, I'll tell you, Diane, we have a plethora of superstars, young kids coming through just now. They're already there. Theo Gegenhardt, the English boy, surprisingly winning the Giro d'Italia. Egan Bernal flopping in the Tour de France, but Tadej Pogacar was there to take over from him. And Bernal himself, of course, is young enough to come bouncing back next season. We've got Ivanopol, the younger. I'll call him an arrogant Belgian because he's certainly a cocky boy, but he suffered a terrible crash in the Lombardia. And he'll be back big time next year. His confidence is oozing. There's so many, Wout van Aert, there's so many we can talk about. Next year will be the continuation of the youth taking over the world of professional cycling. If I was more than, say, 31 years of age now, 30, 31, I'd be planning my exit from the sport because these kids are coming through at a gallop. And next year, I think the average age of people winning big bike races will be average around 26, 27 years of age.
Wow.
We have lots of 21, 22, 23, 24, 25. Lots of them, all of them now, are going to hit the headlines big time next year.
I think that's really exciting.
It is. No, it's the coming of the ways, and I think it's been well awaited for a long time. But hey, I'm going to be sorry to say goodbye to some of the oldsters too.
True.
Who entertained so royally over the last 10 years, like Nibali and Chris Froome and Peter Sagan. Although, hey, they're not retiring yet. They're going to give the kids a good run for the money.
So maybe what we should do in our sport is what they did in golf and have a Masters cycling season.
Well, we don't have a season such, but we do have master competitions.
Right.
They start a bit late on because officially under the rules of cycling, you can be a veteran at 30 years of age, heavens, but not if you're a professional, of course, but if you've just been a normal cyclist. And our pros are racing on longer than they ever did at 35, 36 years of age. Even look at the great Alejandro Valverde, the Spanish champion. My goodness me, he's 40 years of age turn now. And he's challenging the podium in the Grand Tours still, and he's going to race again next year. Those guys are very, very special, and he's still a big entertainer. So let's hope we're going to see a continued clash of the old and the new.
I agree. So I guess we really should talk about what we were originally going to talk about, and that is it's been about just over 2 years that we lost Paul Sherwin. He was your partner in crime for cycling for so many years, and now something really wonderful is coming out of the unfortunate loss, and that is the Paul Sherwin Project. I want you to tell us about it.
Well, to start with, of course, I brought Paul Sherwin into cycling as a commentator. I knew him for 10 years as a professional cyclist when I was a reporter. A journalist-rider sort of relationship. And when I brought him on board, he sat by me at my side for 33 years after that. Longest-running commentary duo in sport, in any sport. And his death was very sudden. It was December the 2nd, 2018. It's marked on my brain forever. And it was terrible sadness. We've been a long time, 2 years, you say, coming round to what we were going to do with Paul's legacy, because Paul's love for Africa is the same as mine is for Africa. I live in Africa partially as well. My work has been with the animals, with the rhinos and birds and things. Paul himself has helped both the animals and the people of Uganda in particular, and in particular the Karamojin people, which is a tribe a long way outside of Uganda and Kampala, rather, the capital. And he's one of those people. I can't tell you the devastation they suffered when they heard of Paul's passing. Their reaction was second to none. It was terribly tragic for them because Paul was a godfather to them. He could speak the language. He sat with them, he talked with them, and he wanted them to understand what they had, not to be, in a way, jealous of what other people had in European countries, where a bit more, if you like, civilized is possibly the wrong word, but they had a lot more to offer than we did, and Paul was explaining it to them, to tell the world what they've got. So he was trying to bring them up in tourism to use and bring the tourists and house the tourists and educate them and make them enjoy the country, which they take for granted. In addition to that, there was his cycling events over there where he helped them ride mountain bikes and wanted to bring the kids through. And so this was Paul's way of life. When we met, we never talked about cycling. It was our life, absolutely. It was our professional life. But when we met, we talked about the birds and the bees and the animals of Africa and the people and how we could help them. So when he left us rather tragically, we've taken a while to do it properly, but we formed during the year the Paul Sherwin Project.org. That's our .com, sorry, not .org, .com. That's our website. In the last 2 weeks, it's come up and running. We formed a board. I didn't ask for the job, but I got the job of chair of the board. And Catherine Sherwin, Paul's wife, who is, you know, it's taken a little while to recover from all the shock of losing her husband, is now full on with it. She is our vice chairman, and she is quite literally the brains behind it. And other people that Paul and I met in our business life at events have come onto the board with the ideas and to help us. It's been formed as a company in the USA, so USA citizens who take part or donate can claim back the revenue on their tax returns and stuff like that. And all of the money, without exception, we're non-profit, of course, all of the money from wherever it comes will go to projects within Uganda in general and in the area of Karamoja in particular. And we want to continue Paul's legacy in mind, and we want to help the people. We want to stop the slaughtering of the animals, and we want to further just about everything that we've had to do with the African continent, particularly in Paul's case with Uganda. So we're off and running. We launched a wristband with the help of Road ID to remember Paul, and that's gone extremely well. And we raised quite a lot of money from that project. And we have, in the last 2 weeks, made decisions to give money to two projects in Uganda. One is to help young girls get educated properly, through a lady called Florence, who runs a school. These kids are just, by family nature, sent down the gold mines at a very young age. They've got no future. They're abused, and now they've got a chance of a future. We're just continuing what Florence herself started, but we're managing to give her the finance now to get it properly running for these kids. Another one is we're supporting the Paul Sherwin Classic, which is a bicycle race, of course, and Paul put his name to that. Always was there, and that will continue bringing in riders, mainly from the African continent, to take part in that event once a year. So there's only two. We're only just starting. It's just getting off the ground now. And if anybody's interested, please take a look at our website, paulsherwinproject.com. Remember how you spell Sherwin, because most people spell it wrongly. Sherwen, the Paul Sherwin Project.com. Yeah. Happy with the way it's going. And to quote Catherine, she rang me up last Sunday, it was. She said, this time last year, as Christmas approaching the first anniversary of Paul's passing, she was feeling very low. She said, this Christmas, it's all changed. She has a direction, a way of remembering Paul, and a way of helping the people Paul loved. And so she's actually looking forward to Christmas this year.
So will you be able to get over there this year?
No, unfortunately not. It's the first time for 25 years I've been in this house on this day, which is December, for all that time, because we can get in now to South Africa, but we can't get out of Britain for holidays only. So there's a bit of an irony there, because normally you get shut in South Africa, as I was for 2 months in February, March, April time. But no, I will get back in the new year, and of course things have happened during the COVID for the better. We have Zoom now. We can talk to the people, and you don't pay for the calls. So we are much closer to the people now when we're not in the country than we ever were before. So we can talk things through in a nice manner.
We will put up all the information about the project on our social media. Of course, it'll go out to everybody who listens to the show. As always, it is just delightful to talk with you, and we will check in again. How about mid, like, race season next year, and then also see how the project's going?
Whenever you wish, Dan, you'll be very welcome. We'll chat. We'll leave it till the new year till we see where we're all going with COVID. But I'm rather hoping, I don't believe for one moment we're going to return to normal next year. I think it will still be disrupted. However, I think the tunnel, the light at the end of it, will be getting a little bit more visible, and I certainly hope.
Well, I hope you stay healthy. I hope you stay well and stay safe, and we will talk again. Have a happy, happy holiday. And when you talk to Catherine, although I'm in contact with her too, you tell her I said so too.
I most certainly will, Diane. We have a board meeting this week, and I quite look forward to them, really. You all have a good time too, especially your listeners, because I wish them all very well. Happy festive season.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you, Diane.
Bye-bye.
Okay, love. Bye-bye.
Bye. If you are interested in learning more about the Paul Sherwin Project, please log on to paulsherwin.com. And of course, you will hear the voice of cycling all next year when Phil Liggett dons his headphones and microphone to announce the races in his inimitable style. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll chat with the force of nature, also known as Catherine Bertin. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. A bicycle crash is not an accident. And when you find yourself in a situation that calls for experienced, effective, and positive legal support and advocacy, you can depend on any of North America's independent Bike Law members. Bike Law's cycling attorneys are members of our community committed to the pursuit of cycling safety and justice. For more information about Bike Law, log on to bikelaw.com. They're on your left, protecting your rights. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. Catherine Bertin has taken the high road to success. Using what she calls visionary teamwork and benevolent disruption to speak her truth, which, it turns out, is what everybody is not only thinking, but what pretty much everybody wants, equality, or at least equal opportunity. After she signed her first professional contract, her female team manager warned her to keep quiet about the inequity in women's sports. Stop talking about this equality crap. No one will listen to you. You are a nothing. You are a no one. But as you will hear in the following conversation, Catherine says that change is possible. Activism isn't relegated to the wealthy, the famous, the politicians, and supporters. We regular people have the power to make change happen too. Catherine, welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks so much for joining me today. How are you?
Hi, Diane. It's so nice to be back. Thank you. I'm doing well and keeping busy, and it's great to talk to you again after, what's it been, 5 years?
I think so. No, we last spoke in 2014. Guess what? Yeah, six years, actually. Almost to the day, it looks like. So you're out in the Tucson area. Is it nice?
It is. It is right now. December and January are coldest months, but by coldest, we mean 65 degrees. So, you know, we're doing okay out here.
That's just obnoxious.
Because, sorry, everybody.
Yeah. Right. December and January, Northeast Ohio. We won't even get into it. So many things have happened since the last time we spoke. And today we're going to talk about your new book, but I want to catch up over these 5 years, because the last time we spoke, you had just released your really great documentary, Half the Road. So let's back up a little bit. Tell us what you've been up to since 2014, and especially your quest for women's equality, which, of course, is, you know, your abiding interest.
It's such a great question. There has been a lot that's happened, both personally and professionally, in the last 6 years. And so much of it really, truly stems from Half the Road, because that journey was such an entry for me in terms of the activism and, you know, fighting for change for women and equality. So after Half the Road came out, you know, what was happening behind the scenes at that point was that we were working with ASO to form La Course by Tour de France. And that was all happening behind the scenes because ASO had this ridiculous gag order on our group where they didn't want any of this known by the public. It pretty much, I think, because they wanted all the credit for creating La Course. And I have no problem with that. You know, if you want to take all the credit, that's great. But the rest of the world already knew from signing the petition of almost 100,000 signatures that we had pushed for change. So if you're trying to keep something secret that has already been very, very public, you know, that made us chuckle.
You think?
Yeah, exactly. And we're like, okay, whatever. But, you know, so behind the scenes, La Course was happening. And then that did happen in 2014. And, you know, it's still happening. We still push behind the scenes where ASO has failed their promise. What was supposed to start as one day was supposed to grow by 3 to 5 days each year until we reached full equity with the 3-week Tour de France. And as we know, ASO didn't hold that up. They are now still doing 1 to 2 days of La Course rather than the full thing. We are crossing our fingers. We've heard rumor that there could be a 10-day Tour de France for women, but we're also very aware that ASO likes to put this out there in very vague terms, like, oh, we're working on it, but yet there's no date set, right? So I won't get excited until I see it's actually on the calendar. So that's a little bit of the activism that we've been working on there. My most recent endeavor, but this actually took place in 2016, is Homestretch Foundation. When I retired from pro cycling at the end of 2016, after 5 years in the sport at the pro level, I started a foundation that helps female cyclists and other female professional athletes that struggle with the gender pay gap in sport. And then behind the scenes, we work to change that. The good news is after fighting for about 7 years trying to change the fact that we have no base salary for women at the World Tour level, we actually won that. And the UCI this past year, 2020, has started a base salary for women at the World Tour team. So that's amazing. But of course, being ASO, rather than go to full equity immediately, they're taking 3 years to build it to full equity. Go figure.
Yeah, right? Go figure. Exactly.
Go figure. Let's see. On the personal side, I mentioned that I retired from racing at the end of 2016. So basically that 2017 was my first year away from pro racing. But in 2016, in my last year racing for Silence Pro Cycling, I had a really devastating crash at one of the UCI races down in Mexico. A rider error ahead of me. She went down and I was the first in line to impact and ended up breaking my skull and almost dying right there on the pavement, and was luckily saved by the doctor in the caravan. It was a crazy ordeal to undergo a traumatic brain injury, and miraculously, I survived, and now I get to claim that I'm 99% as weird as I ever was. So, you know, mostly back in action, very minor side effects.
Lucky.
Yeah. So that was definitely the most dramatic point, I would say, in the past 6 years.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you for those who are either just joining us or don't know. We are speaking with Catherine Bertine. And what's so interesting about Catherine is she's relentless. She's just relentless in her pursuit of women's equality in our sport. And I really appreciate all the work that you do. And one of the things I wanted to talk about, I really didn't realize the crash was so devastating. I mean, this is somehow I missed the severity of what happened. And I'm really happy that, well, I mean, when we started talking today, I'm like, wow, she sounds so good. So apparently you are back. I'm going to say 100%. I wanted to ask you about some of the, you call them discoveries you've made. You refer to them as visionary teamwork and benevolent disruption. I love that term. And,
oh, thank you.
And I wanted to know, who were the other Olympian compatriots who sort of joined you in this gargantuan effort?
Oh, I love that you bring that up. I try to tell this to everybody that I meet, that any of the activism that I've done or started, it was all a team effort that made these results happen. And, you know, let's start with Le Tour Entier, which was the pressure group I put together to fight for change at the Tour de France. And that included Chrissy Wellington, who is a four-time Ironman world champion, Emma Pooley, who is, you know, an Olympic silver medalist and a multiple Olympian and world champion in cycling, and Marianne Vos, who is the boss of women's pro cycling, an amazing athlete, double gold medalist in the Olympics. And she has so many world championships, I've lost track.
Right.
And then there's me. And where I think it's so important that people know, well, their palmares so incredibly outweigh what I've ever accomplished in sport. What my contribution was to bringing this group together. You know, I was able to be a cog in the wheel of progress, even though I'm not an Olympian, I'm not famous, I'm not wealthy, but I do have the power of making something happen through connection. And I hope that everybody knows that and takes that with them to whatever areas of life they might want to change, because that's really what will make the magic happen. And the backstory there is that I have been pestering ASO for years by myself on my own, saying, hey, we got to make some changes. They didn't listen to me. When I banded together with others, that's when they started paying attention. And we all have the power to make that happen. So let's see, that was for Le Tour Entier. And mostly these athletes, these amazing athletes that I met, were women that I had interviewed along the way for Half the Road. And let's see, you know, I can also say in there that Dotsy Bausch is an Olympic silver medalist in track cycling. This is a woman that I befriended during my career. I just feel so incredibly fortunate to know all of these women who align with principles and missions, and they're not afraid to put their voice or their actions out there. So when I talk about the visionary teamwork, it's finding other people who have that like-minded drive to make something happen. And then you guys sit down together and, you know, crank that out. I would say to anybody out there who has a desire to make change in a certain area, put that out there publicly, privately, let people know you're looking for others who, you know, align with your vision and you want to make something happen. And it's amazing who you can find who's, you know, going to stand in your corner. As for the benevolent disruption, as I call this is something that I learned along the way, that when you want to make change happen, you know, a lot of these issues, especially for inequality, where women don't have the same opportunity as men, that can be, for me as a woman, it's absolutely annoying and it sparks some anger, right? Like, why? Why wouldn't women have this chance? And what we have to do with benevolent disruption is not target the effective change with anger, right? If I were to just be angry and rail at UCI and ASO, that doesn't help, right? It's about finding the way to benevolently disrupt their thinking without being angry and mad all the time, because, you know, no one wants to be around that. So neither do, you know, companies and corporations. You know, why would they want to pay attention to you? So it's about finding the win-win for both parties and why they should listen to us when we call for change.
So interesting. Because what, you know, what I'm hearing is it doesn't just apply to our sport. It doesn't just apply to the ASO or the UCI. If you take it across the board to some of the things that have been going on in 2020, the protests and the anger and the upset, and you get a side of it. I mean, you understand the rage and where it's coming from, but does it really move it forward? You know, does it really help make the change, or does it just piss people off?
Exactly. And, you know, I think that we can all see evidence of this on social media, you know, Twitter or Facebook. I specifically target Twitter and Facebook because that's where you can share articles as opposed to Instagram, where there's not a lot of article sharing there.
Right.
We see it all the time. And where if somebody is just railing relentlessly on Twitter or Facebook, that can turn people off. But if you can find solutions and incorporate that, with your ideas of, like, how do we fix this? You know, I always say that one of the most key ingredients of activism is a sense of humor, you know, and we see that on social media too. If you can poke fun of what's happening, you get a lot more people to pay attention. And if you can poke fun of something yet offer solutions, that's even better. And I've seen that too. There are plenty of times on Twitter or Facebook where I will take a jab at UCI or ASO, but in a realm of humor. And those are actually the links and the tweets and the posts that get shared the most. So I think it's important for us to remember that when we're delving into activism, no one wants to listen to a complainer. We want to listen to possible solutions so that, you know, there is an exit strategy, right?
Once again, we're speaking with Catherine Bertin. We're talking about benevolent destruction, which I just love it. I can't wait to adopt that. And we are going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about her new book, Stand. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Back on The Outspoken Cyclist, we're speaking with Catherine Bertin. She is a force of nature, and you need to pay attention to what she has to say if you're interested in getting things done, because she does. So let's talk about Stand. The subtitle of the book is A Memoir and Manual on Activism, A Journey Through What Really Happens When We Stand Up and Fight for Change. So it not only offers us a clue about the contents of the book, a memoir and a manual, it really gives us a clue into you. Give us some insight into the memoir part. What are you telling us about you?
Great question. I really found that when we step into the role of activism, it blurs the line between professional and private lives. You can't just hang up your activism coat at the end of the day and think it won't affect your personal world as well, because if you're passionate about something, it seeps into both areas. And that can be a very good thing. Or if we can't compartmentalize now and then, it can also be a destructive thing. But for me, I really knew that I had to add the memoir side, the personal side of this journey, because if I were to just sit there and write kind of a manual style book of, like, here's how to make change happen.
Right.
Like, just do this. You know, I actually tried that. The first draft of Stand, this was way back when, I would say maybe 2015. You know, it's like, here's how you make change happen. It was awful. I threw out that draft because it just was completely dry. There was no heart and soul to it. And I thought to myself back then, I said, you know what? I think if I'm going to really write about this journey of activism, I need to include what's happened to me along the way so people truly have a better picture. But even then, back in 2015, I still had so much to personally go through, like the brain injury that was going to happen next year, you know? And then that, of course, healing from that, then that puts me into 2017. So I didn't actually start that new draft of Stand until 2017, a couple years later. And that's when I had to kind of sit down in front of the mirror and say, all right, if you're going to do this, it means you're going to have to put some vulnerability out there, some authenticity out there, and it might be really uncomfortable and personal. But I also had a feeling that that's what would connect with readers. And I got a hint of that in 2016 when I sat down with Bicycling Magazine. They had asked that question, what happens when you stand on the front lines of change? And I went into the story, and I did get vulnerable and personal on all of the stuff happening behind the scenes, from stuff that was happening in my pro cycling career, stuff that was happening at home on the marriage front lines, depression that was happening. So I really kind of got transparent. And what ended up happening was the response response that came back from the readers of that article was incredible. You know, I was worried that the trolls were just going to just hack me down into little pieces. And of course, there are always some who do. But the majority of the feedback from that article, it was people who were writing in saying things like, wow, now that she's, you know, told us how she struggled, I feel like I'm not so alone. I struggle too. It actually ended up being Bicycling's most highest selling magazine of the year.
Wow.
And
good for you.
Yeah. Well, I give all credit to the writer of that article, Steve Freeman, for really putting it out there, you know, and doing a great job, because it obviously it wasn't my athletic accomplishments that put me so far ahead of the game. I think it was just the fact of being able to be vulnerable and having this writer really do a lovely job with the story. I also like to give credit to Bicycling Magazine. They put me on the cover for that issue, and I write about this a little bit in Sand, and how amazing that one of their magazines, as we both know, Diane, the cycling industry is predominantly male. We're seeing some great change there. More women are getting into the sport, but when a magazine with a woman who's on the cover, and mind you, I was riding a bike with my helmet and sunglasses on. It wasn't like I was sitting there in some glammed up cover model style type shoot. I was a woman racing her bike, right? And that was on the cover. So to know that that was one of the highest selling issue because of the article and because of the cover gives me a lot of pride in saying, hey, we need to put more women front and center for any magazine that caters more toward a male audience readership, because we'll actually attract more women to investing in this type of sale as well. So that's a happy point.
It's so interesting that you say that, having been in the industry since the 1970s, and I was in it from a retail perspective, and talk about, and you'll excuse the expression, both you and listeners, you know, that old white boy network. And I'm only now, 40 some odd years later, really seeing change. And it's because of young women like you. And I really have to say, I appreciate it. And I'm glad you're standing up for me. You know, I get to hear that. That is so cool. So I want to ask you the manual part of the book. Is it actually a roadmap on how to get involved and how to sort of affect change?
Yes, great question. I thought about how I wanted to incorporate the manual elements into the book. And by the end of finishing the, you know, the draft, I decided that I would put the manual at the back of the book, because it would make more sense and serve as more impactful if I gave my story first. That way, in the manual, I could refer to things, you know, that I had already brought up. So in the back, yeah, I think I've got 20 steps in there. I shouldn't say steps as much as 20 points, you know, of if you're going to stem into activism, here are the things that either helped or hindered me along the way. And those things make a lot more sense after reading the book. So there is actually a manual in the back. And to me, that also felt more natural than doing something like bullet points at the end of each chapter. That's not my style of reading. I always feel that those books come across a little bit textbook style to me. And I think what I really wanted to do was steer away from the textbook style and say, here's the journey and here's what I learned. And, you know, and I have plenty of things in there that, you know, maybe didn't go right for me or different directions that I had to take. And so that's in there too, so that people understand. You know, it's not like I have all the answers.
Right.
Follow all the areas where I messed up, too. Make sure you don't do that.
Once again, let me remind listeners, I'm speaking with Catherine Bertin. We're going to wrap it up in a few minutes here, but I have several other points I want to cover. And one is the events of this past year. I mean, we've had races canceled. Life has been canceled. We've had this horrible pandemic. And all kinds of other problems, well, including Mr. Floyd, and, you know, it's just beyond words sometimes. It's so horrifying. Do you think these events can be looked at through the lens of your ideas, that you can take some of these events and sort of turn them around and shove them through some of your ideas to come out the other side of another way to look at what could have happened and then what we could do going forward?
Oh, what a great question, Diane. Absolutely. There are definitely some components that line up with, you know, the activism guide and the principles that I use. And I think the first one definitely is the teamwork element. And what a hell of a year, right?
Yes.
And from racial injustice to, you know, everything politically that was just incredibly mind-boggling, right? There's so much happening. And I think that we the people saw a lot of power happen when people banded together in communities, as well as, of course, celebrities would also do this. But when we saw this change happen where people were not afraid to speak out and speak up, especially with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and everything that was happening on the racial front, if there's any silver lining, it's that impact of what happened when people came together to protest and stand for what they believed. That is something that I think is truly remarkable. And if we lose sight of that, then it would be just so incredibly depressing to think that, you know, are we going backward or why is this happening? But when we look at how we're moving forward, because people were coming together. And then, of course, the media, I think, did an amazing job in casting their spotlight and their cameras on all of those who were protesting and coming out to fight for change. So there's definitely an upside there that we need to pay attention to as individuals, that when we create a group environment, a team environment, we're a lot harder to ignore. That's so important.
Excellent point. All right. What's next for you? I mean, I don't know how you could even find time to do more, but what are you working on right now? Stand is now published, and we will tell people how they can pre-order it. When I say it's published, it's getting ready to ship 1st of February, and I want to know what you're doing. So what's next?
Well, I have to say that between now and February, everything that I'm doing is very much book-related.
Okay.
This time, this particular journey with the book Stand, which is my fourth book, I'm taking a new direction. My first three books were all published by traditional companies.
Right.
You know, the ones that you see on bookshelves, in bookstores, front and center, you know, and I never had to do any marketing or media or anything. That's what traditional publicists take off your plate as an author. But this time around, I decided to go the self-publishing route, specifically because my agent was getting countless rejections from the mainstream publishers who actually said, we don't think a book about women who stand up for and fight for change is going to sell. They actually said that.
You know, were they all men? I'm sorry.
Oh, no. But that's a great question. We had tons of rejections from both men and women.
How interesting.
But what it stems back to, I think, is how the publishing industry has changed. And, you know, when my first book came out in 2003, when the internet itself was still an infant and we didn't have any social media, back then, publishers wanted originality and things that had never been published before, because that's what the publishing market was all about. Now, since the advent of social media, where things can be shared so easily, publishing markets stick to the same realms of tradition, and they keep putting out the same types of book over and over again, you know, whatever's on the bestsellers list, and then there'll be a spinoff of that in some way. So what was happening with my book proposal for Stand, they were looking around the industry and saying, well, wait, there aren't any other books out there about people and women who stand up and fight for change. So therefore, this won't sell. And I'm sitting there like, you've got to be kidding me. Have you looked out the window and paid attention to our social and political climate? You don't think this will sell?
So small-minded. It's so interesting.
Very.
So interesting.
Very.
I did see that it's something PR by the book. And I'm really kind of fascinated by the whole concept of you self-publishing this.
Yeah, it's something else. Of course, in this modern day and age, anybody can self-publish,
right,
usually via Amazon. That's probably the corner market, right?
Right.
But what people, I think, need to realize is that self-publishing doesn't mean that you upload a Word document and then it gets sewed into a book form and there you go, it's all done. You know, what I'm learning and what is so hard and so much work behind the scenes is what you have to do behind, you know, behind all of that. For example, formatting, page layout, making sure nothing gets cut off the edges. And if you, you know, indentation, all of this is totally different. It's to the extent where I've hired what I am dubbing a tech guru,
right?
A friend who has been through the self-publishing world before, and I've teamed up with him and said, I really need some help with this. Can you guide me in how this works? And I also have hired editor, copy editor, graphic designer for the cover. And then PR by the book is my publicity firm I've hired to get farther reach into the world. And all of these things, it's so much work, you know. So I do feel like, you know, behind the scenes, I am pretty much at my computer from 9 to 5 each day, making sure all of these areas are happening so that when we get to February 1st, when it's launched into the universe, at least I can rest easy knowing I've done everything on my end to hopefully get it out to the masses. And so that's what I'm working on.
And it makes perfect sense. Well, I'm excited to know that we'll be able to order it. Let me tell listeners a little bit on that front. So the book is called Stand, and the subtitle that came in, One Woman Challenged Sexism, Traditionalism, Oppression, and Personal Demons as She Fought for Women's Inclusion at the Tour de France and Won. So while that's not all there is, that's enough to sort of spark most people's interest. Let my listeners know how they can pre-order a copy of it.
Thank you. And Diane, I'll quickly clarify that that's not the direct subtitle, but just a synopsis of what the book is about. But I'll just throw this out there. The subtitle is A Memoir on Activism, A Manual for Progress, and What Really Happens on the Front Lines of Change.
Okay. So, I like that better.
Yep. So the way that people can find the book is if you go to your Amazon browser and you type in Catherine Bertine Stand, it will pop up and it's available as an ebook and a hardcover right now. In the future, paperback will be added, but those two are available for pre-order. You know, there will be a link on my website as well, which is CatherineBertine.com. But I always like to tell people that if you're international, my link is for U.S. Amazon, and to find it in your country, you just have to enter my name and the title, and it'll pop up.
In fact, what a cute cover.
Thank you. Can I tell you about the cover?
Yes.
Oh, you're looking at the poster where I'm holding up the equal sign, yeah?
Okay. When you look at just the little tiny one, it looks like a toaster, but when you open it up, it looks like a poster. Okay.
It's a poster.
I see yes, that.
Exactly. Exactly. And it stems from when in 2013 I went to World Championships and I held up an equal sign when I was at the sign-in stage for the road race. And all I did, you know, when they called my name was I went up there and held up an equal sign for a few seconds and then I left the stage. And the UCI fined me €50. Luckily, a wonderful photographer from Italy, you know, part of the media in Italy, took a picture of me just holding up the sign. And he had sent that photo to me. And I knew something about it. I said, wow, okay, in the future, maybe there's a place where I can use this photo. So we adapted it. When I say we, that's part of Team Stand, you know, my graphic designer. And I collaborated and I said, look, I don't need my mugshot on the face of this book. You know, I don't want it to be about me. I want it to be about standing. And so we came up with this design. She did an amazing job creating the artwork and the power of that image. So that's what you're seeing. And then in the book, it'll actually have the photograph of where it comes from. But it feels really good on a personal level. Cover feels really good on a personal level. Because, you know, taking what UCI deemed fine worthy and flipping it around, saying like, you're not going to stop me or anybody who stands up for equal rights for women.
Wow. What a great place to end our conversation, equal rights for women and stand up. Well, Catherine, it's just been a wonderful conversation again. I really appreciate you taking time to speak with me. I hope you're going to do something fun for the holidays. Who knows, right?
if fun means like going outside for a walk, you know.
Well, there is that. Yes. Thank you again. So once again, we've been speaking with Catherine Bertin. Her new book, Stand, is available for pre-order. And I can't wait to read the whole book. Thank you so much for talking with me, and have a wonderful, safe holiday.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you, listeners. And we'll talk again soon.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Catherine Bertin joined me from her home in Tucson, Arizona. If you are interested in learning more about Catherine and her work, you can log on to Catherine, that's K-A-T-H-R-Y-N, Bertin, Bertine.com. And if you want a copy of Stand, you can pre-order it for February arrival at all the usual places. Next week, Charles Pelkey, Patrick Mad Dog O'Grady, and I are going to introduce you to the Monsignor. Yes, puzzle on that for the week. So I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you have a great week. Please stay safe. Please stay well. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show, and we welcome your thoughts and comments. We'll be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and most other podcast apps, and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.